I'm Christopher Lydon, looking again at the God question in our time, in our university neighborhood of brain scientists, mathematicians, psychologists, literary folk, with the philosopher-novelist Rebecca Goldstein. Her new book is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. And this is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude from the Watson Institute at Brown University. Those 36 arguments rage inside the head of the novel's protagonist, Cass Seltzer. He's a best-selling psychologist of religion. Time magazine has dubbed him the atheist with a soul. He's moving between Brandeis and Harvard universities and trying to take his stand between the death of God and the ecstasy of belief. Who knew, Rebecca Goldstein, that in the precincts of Harvard, MIT, Brandeis, all these brainy institutions where this novel unfolds, in what I call the frontal lobe of the universe, who knew the old riddles of faith and reason, belief, disbelief, of God, were pulsing away with such huge effect? This book is, for me, a kind of map I'd never seen of intellectual, spiritual life at a high level around Boston, Cambridge.
Yes, of course, it's true that to be human is to be filled with ontological wonder, especially for thinkers. Ultimately, what we're all trying to answer, scientists and philosophers and theologians and believers, non-believers, is what sort of world are we living in? What is the nature of this universe? And how can I find my place in it? But before I can and can figure it out, just what sort of world is it? Is it one of randomness, or is it one that has purpose shot through, threaded through it? Anybody, I think, certainly when I started college thinking I was going to be a physicist, and it was this question: what's the nature of this universe? Is it a world of elementary particles, or guided by mathematical laws, is it something else? I came from a religious background, and so many of the physicists that I knew and continue to know, what motivates them is this basic question. I call this the ontological urge that I think any thinker has.
Spell that out, the ontological urge.
The ontological urge is the avid curiosity to figure out what is the nature of our location in the most cosmic sense. Here we are. We're situated in this world. What sort of world is it? What are the ultimate guiding forces and powers? I think to be human, is to have this urge. At least if one has I suppose it's an indulgence and it's a symptom of living a very good life to be able to completely give yourself over to these questions. But once that's in place, I think these sorts of questions are very natural.
I think so too, and I think it's a relief to hear somebody not only say it, but surface all the life that goes on around these questions, and many kinds of life: egomaniacs, careerism, love affairs, scientific arguments, public debates. They're all in the book. Come back, though, for a moment to the two sort of battlefronts of the God Wars today. For one thing, there are the famous book wars of Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett. And on the other hand, Harvey Cox and Cornel West and Karen Armstrong and Mary Gordon and so many others. There's that world. And then at an American political level, there was faith-based Bush administration and a kind of pushback, too. Where do you see these characters in those two battles? Or is there a sort of a third front of the ivory tower?
Both sides will often offend me. And I think that's why I felt I had to write the novel, that I get offended when I hear. I agree with Sam Harris. I'm on his Reason. I'm on his board, the Reason Foundation board.
Really?
Yes, I agree with him. In terms of our metaphysics is the same, but I'm so very uncomfortable with sort of some of the belittling descriptions of religious people. I'm not saying that he does it, but I sometimes hear that sort of description. You know, this is the fallacy that they're making. This is the mistake. You know, if only we could point out where their reasoning goes astray. I think religion is so much more complicated than that. I think religious emotions are so much more complicated than that. One of the things that Spinoza taught us, and it's being validated finally in neuroscientific labs, is that emotions and intellect, cognitions and passion, are inextricably bound up with one another. Cognitive states are also emotional states, and emotional states make cognitive claims. And so even those of us who believe in reason, and again, this is pure Spinoza, this itself is an emotional experience. And so the, you know, to be moved by reason, to I break into tears at beautiful mathematical proofs, you know, that they move me to tears, that this kind of intertwining is something that we all share once again. And so the notion that we could, on the reason side, that we could just go through, you know, the arguments and show what's wrong and people would stop believing is very, very false. There are reasons other than just strict logical arguments for people to be believing. On that, so that offends
but
me.
Why draw a hard line between your experience of a mathematical truth or a demonstration or beauty that brings you to tears and a Dostoevskian epiphany of the Almighty?
I do believe, ultimately, in terms of establishing truth, in objective means. That is, if it's based on a personal experience, if it's nothing but this personal experience, and so you can't offer grounds that everybody can evaluate, I don't trust that, because people have all sorts of lunatic personal experiences, and it's not something to be trusted. This is something we've developed, and that's why science developed, that's why philosophy developed, that you have these grounds that can be shared and that can be subjected to critical analysis by others. An experience of the world can be, if it can't be shared, if you can't offer grounds for others to evaluate, it could be lunacy. And
but not to argue these points, what is the value of a scientific truth that doesn't move one in the end?
But
and why
did,
shouldn't
yes.
an individual experience of truth and beauty be entirely individual and maybe even momentary?
Exactly. So we have to distinguish between two things. And in fact, in saying that the emotions and the intellect are inextricably bound, I was trying to say that, yes, truth itself, I think, is a moving experience for us. We are, that's part of the having the ontological urge. We really would like to know the truth, not just the truth that flatter our own ego, although we're very given to that sort of thing, but we would like to really know the objective truth, and we have an emotional reaction. I think there's an evolutionary explanation for that as well. We have evolved to appreciate the value of truth because it has great survival value to know what the nature of the world that we live in. And so I think there's a good evolutionary explanation for our swelling pleasure, expansive pleasure in knowing the truth. However, that is different from saying that swelling, expansive emotional Dostoevskian or whatever experience is in itself grounds for the truth, for believing that something is true. I mean, I could wake up tomorrow and have the expansive, pleasurable, swelling, emotional revelation that I'm the Messiah. I don't believe in religious enthusiasm, that sort of, experiential basis, personal experiential basis that cannot be shared with anybody else, that it's a purely subjective, unshareable experience given to me personally by the universe.
Your nominally atheistic character shares that rapture in a Hasidic sect that he would find in any other way a completely off the chart.
You know, he gets dubbed the atheist with a soul, and he is the atheist with a soul. He knows this experience. He knows what it's like, but he resists drawing conclusions from it. He'll be swept away by it. Then he will subject it to critical analysis.
Why not affirm it in his person, in his experience, in his rapture?
the history of our species is filled with people being enraptured and enthralled and having private revelations that are completely counter to each other, right? And slaughtering each other because of these things. The Enlightenment grew out of. John Locke, for example, has an essay on enthusiasm, on religious enthusiasm, and saying, look, it's not a source of truth. It's very, very powerful, and I wanted to show this. It is powerful, and it is ecstatic. I'm very prone to it myself. I often say I spend more time sort of out of my mind than in my mind. I'm extremely prone to this sort of thing. But to get back to Locke, I mean, he said, you know, people have been enraptured. Some have been enraptured and known for a certainty. It has that feeling of such finality, such conclusiveness to have this experience. Some have had it for proposition P and some have had it for proposition not P. They can't both be right. P and not P cannot both be true. And therefore, this is not a reliable guide to truth, as powerful and as wonderful it is. I trust there are all sorts of intellectual gifts that give us this feeling. For me, science, for me, math, art, music, that same kind of ecstatic being swept away outside of oneself, philosophy. And it's a kind of religious experience, you know, but it's for me, these are much safer than trying to answer the nature of the universe, what kind of universe we live in. Is it one in which we should take our marching orders from the universe, or are we responsible ourselves? So, or do we have to figure this out for ourselves? That God Almighty important question can't be entrusted to enthusiasm.
There are times, though, when you have to trust your ecstasy, you have to trust your goosebumps, you have to trust your emotions, not as the source of the truth, but as a register of truth. And to say, whether you're looking at a lover or a book or a poem or a painting or contemplating God, you're onto something.
To say you have to is ambiguous. I mean, you in some sense, you do have to psychologically, but do you have to... logically, can you, in fact, or epistemologically, is this a good theory of knowledge to trust these enthusiasms, even in love? I mean, and in fact, one of the themes of the book, and Cass himself, my character, doesn't see this until the end, is that this sort of religious enthusiasm being carried away by the ecstasy of the moment, which, you know, I feel sorry for anybody who isn't susceptible to that sort of thing. That to me is a soulless person who isn't susceptible to this sort of thing. But that it's all over the place, and including it's the downside of it, the illusions that come with it. And it's not just in specifically religious context, but in academia, in the deification of certain cult figures and you know, in graduate students falling under the spell of certain, you know, cult figures, or in romantic love. And that Cass doesn't realize until very, very late in the novel that one of the varieties of religious illusion is, you know, romantic love. So that kind of, again, you know, I know it, it's goosebumps, I know it in my, I don't need any evidence, I don't really need to know what this person is like. I know, I look into her eyes and I see her soul. You know, as many of us have learned through one experience after the other, that's not entirely reliable either. And that is it's akin to what happens in the religious emotions. And that's one of the themes. Again, it's my argument with the new atheist that, you know, even when we think we're being so very reasonable and we reject religion because of that, be aware that it's sneaking into one's lives. That same impulse is sneaking into one's lives in other ways. Tribalism, for example. You know, so the new, you know, that sometimes atheists have a certain tribal instinct. Let's band together, and if anybody says something a little bit, which I might be doing, I don't know, a little bit counter to what has been laid out by the dogma, you know, we're going to push them out of the tribe. This occurs all over, in academia, in pro-reason, in pro-science. Science itself has these aspects to it. One of the things that I did want to say with the book is it's the religious impulse with its ecstasies and its fallacies. It's far more widespread than simply in strictly religious contexts.
Come back to two critical characters in your novel, Rebecca. These 36 arguments for the existence of God, and you always insist on including, as a subtitle, a work of fiction. Two critical characters, Cass Seltzer, the atheist with a soul, and then we got to come to Azaria, too, a child. He's the Alyosha Karamazov in this story. He's the hope of the future. But first, Cass, to what degree is Cass Seltzer an answer, a resolution, a bridge between Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris on one side and Harvey Cox or Cornel West on the other, say, in the current public culture wars around God? What does Cass Seltzer do to end that war?
He agrees on the nature of the universe with Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins. He has their same view of what the universe is like. He does not believe that there is a transcendent creator of the universe. He most emphatically does not believe that morality needs religion. He has a big showdown, a debate over, resolve, God exists, and he takes the negation of that. And the debate evolves into a discussion about morality, and he's very, very firm and unwavering on the position, as is his author, that the grounding of morality does not come from religion. Religion actually doesn't help us with the grounding of morality.
Eternal punishment and all that, hellfire. Yeah.
This is a pernicious and insulting view that those who have a different ontology, a different notion of that they have arrived at with intellectual rigor and integrity are not to be trusted on issues of morality, that they have no sense of the difference between right and wrong. This is something very, very pernicious and, a great fallacy. So Cass Seltzer really, wants to concentrate on that very much. So far, all of this is consistent with Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and all. The difference is, I suppose, that he sees this religious impulse breaking out in so many places, that in some sense it's part of what it is to be human. It is, we have to beware always, but also in at times enjoy it and give way to it, certainly in issues like falling in love, our being carried away in moments of ecstasy over science or truth itself. And he stresses the experiential aspects of our ontological searches, perhaps a bit more than these, and tries to say, look, there's common ground here. To be human, to be fully human, is to be susceptible to transcendence. And that is a wonderful thing, and those who are religious and those who are not are all engaging in this sort of experience.
This is the William James contribution.
I think William James longed himself to be religious, to believe in the truths of religion, and kept coming up with arguments, including this pragmatic argument in Leap of Faith. Cass resists that, and when it comes to all of the arguments to actually believe the universe is this way, does contain God, he resists that. But he's with William James in appreciating the experience of transcendence that is given to atheists as well. The ontological urge was very, very strong in William James, but so was the scientific urge. He demanded impersonal, scientific, shared grounds that we could all have access to, and that would convince him.
That's the William James who stands behind your man Cass Seltzer to some degree. Talk about Azaria, though. Azaria Shiner, a little boy in the most restrictive kind of Hasidic community in New Jersey. Turns out he's a mathematical prodigy. There comes a moment in his life where he's invited as a little teenager to come to MIT, and he faces this choice. He decides, as he says, it's necessary to go to MIT, but impossible to stay in the New Walden community of Hasidic Jews is impossible, but necessary. And yet he works it out. I finished the book wondering, in what sense is Azariah the hope of a non-tribal, non-dogmatic, but real religious breakthrough? Your guy, Cass Seltzer, confronting this boy, says toward the end that Azariah is standing at the place where our universe touches the extraordinary. Others would have said the miraculous or the profoundly, profoundly hopeful. What does he mean?
Cass is filled with a kind of awe at Azariah Shiner, not just his prodigious genius, but his moral depth. He is an extraordinary young man. More than the genius is the moral depth, I would say. However, for me as well, a person like Azariah is a place where there is a confluence between our extraordinary universe and the very particular personal, the kind of people that individuals that this species occasionally produces. Many years ago, when I was still in high school, I think, I had read this story by Aldous Huxley called The Young Archimedes, and I reference it in the novel. And it's about, this sophisticated Englishman who's vacationing in Tuscany. His little boy has a playmate, an Italian peasant boy named Guido, who is this untutored, prodigious genius. And this happens in mathematics, that this can happen. Mm. The nature of mathematics is such, because it's non-empirical, you need not know anything about the nature of the world, and you can have this talent for extraordinary discovery in abstract mathematics, and it breaks out. If it's a major talent, it often breaks out at a very, very early age. When I read this story, and it has a tragic ending, the story in Huxley, I immediately, coming from the background that I do, start translating it into Jewish terms. What would it be like to have a child of this nature born into a community in which his talents couldn't flourish? Anomalous, prodigious, one in I don't know how many millions of a type of mind that can give such gifts to our culture, to our understanding. So it would be also a kind of cultural tragedy if it couldn't flourish, if it was lost. What would happen? I didn't really want to write about this boy because I thought it would be an extraordinarily tragic story. And, I live these characters. I cry for these characters. I didn't want to create this boy in order to kill him. I wouldn't be able to bear it. But Azariah emerged for me fully about 15 years ago. And I, I saw him, I heard him, I knew him. I thought I'd have to kill him. And so I was not going to write a book. I was not going to, in fact, I thought it would be a short story, but I was not going to write it. I just couldn't bear to do it. However, then this thing happened. I got drawn into the new atheist debate. I wrote the book on Spinoza that drew me into this debate. I got invited to be a speaker in many free thinker associations, discovered non-religion is also organized and as religion is. And I realized that Azariah, who is the beating heart of this novel. This is where, this is the child I've been carrying around with me for at least 15 years, if not longer, that I would have a wider scope to be able to discuss this issue, these kinds of choices of what happens when religion which is about so much more than the belief in God. It's about bonding to communities, bonding to history, to certain traditions, our responsibilities to others. It's about existential dilemmas. It's about all of that. What happens when these different religious impulses pull at different ways? And one of the things we try to figure out in religion is, what's the nature of the universe? He's figured it out. It's a godless universe for him. In some sense, Azaria is a way of trying to, if not reconcile all of these contradictions, recognize them, appreciate them, appreciate the different ways that different individuals have of dealing with them. I think that's what I wanted to get at. We are pulled apart by contradictions, by contradictory impulses. And this is part of what we're talking about when we're talking about these great debates of our day between religion and science, faith and reason. We have different ways of reconciling them, and we should be aware of different people's ways of reconciling, tolerant of it, appreciative of it. Try to imaginatively inhabit the other and how they're dealing with these contradictions of existence.
Hmm. In my church, we would take it to the Lord, you know?
To me, that's a metaphor.
It's all a metaphor.
It's all a metaphor, you know, and that to the extent that a religion, that one's religious faith gives a sort of false sense of certainty, but also a lack of responsibility, that somehow God is taking care of it, and decreasing the personal sense of responsibility that, you know, we have to take care of it. We have to take care of it for one another. There is not this ultimate justice that's waiting for us, either in this life or the afterlife, that it's our responsibility, that we can decide, we can discover what is right and wrong. We can discover the common humanity of all of us, and that to be human is to be worthy of dignity and respect, that this is, and that we have to take care of each other because there's no big guy taking care of us. To that, to the extent that religion decreases one's awareness of that, I don't like it.
The God question in your novel, Rebecca, infiltrates cognitive science at Harvard and Brandeis and philosophy and literature and mathematics at MIT. And I want you to chase that down. Among other things, I wondered, how did the cast of characters in these debates get so exclusively Jewish? I'm also wondering whether the Asian and Chinese, not to mention Catholic or Protestant scientists in the cognitive sciences today, aren't working out the same fundamental questions in their own terms.
You know, you can't talk about religion in the abstract. You have to pin it down, especially in a novel. It's got to be, you know, you can deal with abstractions, but to be a novelist is to make it concrete, to make it very, very particular. Judaism is the religion that I know. I know it intimately. I
would write about what you know.
Exactly. And when it, so I don't necessarily, I don't want to write, when they say write about what you know, I mean, I find that a little bit limiting, and I wouldn't want to restrict writing all of my novels to things that I've personally experienced. But when it comes to religion, there is one particular religion that I know intimately, and it is Judaism. I come from 12 generations of rabbis, and my brother is a rabbi.
Wow.
I'm the only black sheep in the family, in fact.
The Spinoza, so to speak?
Well, thank you. What can I say? I resonate deeply with Spinoza, and I first came in contact with Spinoza when I was in an all-girls, very, very orthodox school, yeshiva, and he was mentioned as the cautionary tale. This is where, if you ask the wrong questions, little girls, this is where you might end up. And, you know,
thrown out of the synagogue.
Yes, excommunicated from his Jewish community of Amsterdam that consisted of refugees from the Spanish Portuguese Inquisition. So it was a very traumatized and insecure community. Nevertheless, they banished the greatest philosopher that the Jews have ever produced, and it's a shame.
There you are bringing a deep Jewish education to these questions. I'm wondering to what degree these, the Chinese scientists, and a lot of them are Chinese.
Yes.
Can you identify the ontological question in brain science today, for example, or computer sciences, stripped of any particular religious tradition? I mean, what are those sciences adding to our understanding of us in the big, big, big picture?
In the big. So if you want to connect up these questions in cognitive science or in psychology, evolutionary psychology, in neuroscience, with this big ontological question, this big ontological question has very personal meaning. What is the universe? What are we? Are we strictly material systems working according to the laws that govern material systems, or are we something over and beyond? You know, so that is, it's what used to be called, it's still sometimes called, the mind-body problem, which happened to have been the title of my very first novel. It was in some sense what my PhD dissertation was on, but is now called more the hard problem of consciousness. The material for me as a novelist, the inner world. What is the world like for each character? We each carry a different version of the world inside of us, which we're constantly modifying and changing. That is subjectivity. That is what a novelist is exploring. Can subjectivity be explained? Can it be captured in purely impersonal scientific terms? And if it can't, and my view is that it can't, it hasn't been yet, no matter how far we go with cognitive science or artificial intelligence or neuroscience, I mean, the most we get are correlations. Even if it can't, does that show that we are something over and above these material systems? I think not, but I think it just shows something about the limits of scientific description. But here's that ontological question about the nature of the universe being reproduced in this particular question. This world that I carry around, the thing that makes me what I am, and what makes you what you are, this subjectivity, does this show, what's the consequence? What's the ontological payoff of this? What does it show about what we are? Does it show we have a soul, an immaterial soul? This kind of question.
It's the question of the ghost in the machine. Mm-hmm. We know more and more and more about the machine, and yet, as Joan Alera has written, we still experience life as the ghost.
We experience it from the inside, and you can brain image me, and in fact, actually, I was supposed to be I've never had my brain image, but I was. Somebody is doing a project on the brain in love, and so they were going to subject both my husband and me to an fMRI while they show us pictures of each other. It's the ultimate test to see if we're really in love. But the thing is, see which parts of our brains light up when we see pictures of each other, and they were taking us as an example because it's so clear to everybody that we're so very much in love, which we are, that, here they would know, well, okay, here is a person who subjectively is feeling love. Let's look at their brain. But you can't do it the other way around. You can't look at the brain and say, this must be a person who's in love. You have to know that independently and then try to map the areas of the brain that light up. That's another version of the hard
But there's your question right there. And if you saw the fMRI and it was just flatline, and your heart was just pounding with desire and emotion and affection and gratitude and everything else that we define as love, which would you believe? Would you believe your lying heart and say, out the door? Or would you say, no, these scientific measures aren't enough?
The matter of the truth, the fact of the matter, is a subjective state, feeling in love. And you trust the subject. For the subjective state, you trust the subject.
You.
But, when it comes to the nature of the universe, you don't trust the subject. You know, we've developed the means of trying to figure it out. But here, yes, exactly. You trust the subject. When it's a matter of that subjective state for that subject, you have to first ask the subject, and then you try to get the correlations in your machinery. It goes in the opposite direction. That's yet another way. If we were to really solve the hard problem of consciousness, if that were... If the reductionist materialist side were to prevail, then you could put somebody in one of these gadgets, and you would know as well as they precisely what they were feeling without being able to have to ask them anything. And you could tell them things that they were themselves unaware of. People who were agonizing over whether they were in love or not, we could just put them in there and say, yep, go for it. You know, I mean, you laugh because it's absurd. Yes, it is absurd. But who knows? Maybe our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren will be laughing at our laughing, you know, that because things will have got... It would surprise me. And that's part of my metaphysics, you know. It would surprise me. I think one way of judging your metaphysical convictions or your real answers, one measure for it is how surprised would you be to discover the universe was really that way? I would be very surprised to find out there were a God in charge of everything. I'd be quite surprised. I'd be very surprised to discover that we have a soul.
And yet you keep referring to souls. I'm counting your soul references.
I'm a soulful atheist.
Religion is a bet in the end. Pascal's wager and all that, but it's always a bet on, you know, which way do I want to go? My bet is that you're not done with this ontological urge, and neither am I. Thank you for the book. Thank you for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Rebecca Goldstein. Her book is 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction, she adds in the title. Ben Mandelkern read along with us and helped us get ready. Post your own belief about unbelief, your take on neo or paleo atheism, hard or soft, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.